Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Scaffold, a podcast featuring interviews with architects, artists, and designers. I'm your host, Matthew Blunderfield. In this episode, I speak with the architect John Patkow, who along with his partner Patricia, founded Patkow Architects in 1978. Based in Vancouver, the practice has become celebrated for its regionally influenced work and built projects across Canada, from the Seabird Island School in British Columbia to Montreal's Grand Bibliothèque. If their early work was guided by forces of climate, topography, and local culture, their current projects are defined as much by an interest in inherent material properties and their potential to generate new forms. I met John in early January at his office in Vancouver, where we talked about, among other things, his attraction to architects whose work differs from his own, and his and Patricia's curiosity and openness to new approaches to design. We also talked about Patkow Architects' identity as a Canadian practice and how they negotiate both Indigenous and colonial histories in the making of their work. And now, here's the interview. I hope you enjoy it. So happy New Year.
Same to you.
Before we started recording, you were saying in the past you kind of resented breaks in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Because it was enforced downtime that I was frustrated by the sort of lack of infrastructure. Because the way I work now, it's changed over the decades. It used to be when we were drawing, and this practice has been around for quite a while, long before there were computers. And when there was drawing, I was directly connected with the sort of the work product of the office by making drawings. Mm-hmm. But I haven't continued to develop my drawing skills in digital form. And so now I'm removed from the actual document that we produce. And so I'm dependent upon sort of an infrastructure to do my work. Mm. And even now that we use the computer to deal with geometry, drafting on your board is incapable of dealing with some of the geometric configurations that we're now working with. Uh-huh. And so again, I am dependent upon infrastructure. And so if the infrastructure shuts down, I can think about stuff, but I can't do much stuff. And I don't get the kind of feedback that I need. The world has changed because of my failure, I guess, to stay sort of up to date with documentation technology. Mm.
It's an interesting conundrum, mm-hmm. where through time the architect gains experience and knowledge and expertise, but at the same time the modes of production outpace.
Yes, absolutely.
And so what you're describing is a kind of obstacle almost.
It is an obstacle, but it's also, I think, a very positive thing, because it forces you to take a step back, in a sense, to focus on the big picture, not allow yourself to sort of, it's not that you can't allow yourself, you simply are incapable of focusing on the minutiae, because they're out of your grasp. And so this has forced me to make space for others, mm. for one thing. Mm. So the office is larger than it was because I need this infrastructure to do what I want to do. Mm-hmm. But it's given others an opportunity to enter into the discussion and the development of projects in a positive way. So it's been, I think, a very good thing. It's expanded our reach and capacity. It's increased the brain power that the office has available. And it's bringing in subsequent generations in a way that is very important, because there's an inverse relationship to technology and age. And so sometimes in some of the things we do, the most junior people, junior in quotation marks, of the office are essential because of the digital skills that they have that the more senior people in quotation marks don't have. And so there is a real interesting flip in terms of where the skills lie and which skills lie where, and how the layers of experience within the office interact. It's very dynamic, and there is a essential place for everybody, as opposed to in the old days where it used to be where the junior people were more simply instrumental in exercising the instructions of the more senior people.
It seems like this office has really embraced that transition into digital practice. And this was a kind of hinge that I wanted to touch on. I thought it would come across, or I thought it would emerge later in the conversation, but we're here now, so we might as well,
well
talk about it.
We certainly have. I mean, I still draw, and Pat and I both have drafting boards, and we draw. And we tend to use drawing in two ways. One, to facilitate our thinking at the outset of a project, to sort of begin to understand what the project is and what the potential is, and then subsequently to elaborate where speech is inadequate, so sketching, to facilitate a discussion with others who are actually developing digital documents. We still use physical models, especially in certain aspects of our work, which is actually one-to-one scale manipulation of materials, which is part of a research initiative which we have within the office, which has developed in a variety of ways, including furniture now, which is again done physically rather than through a digital medium. We still draw, we still model physically, but we have embraced all of the powerful things that digital technology can do as an expansion of our tools.
I want to try now and kind of chart a trajectory backwards.
Okay.
We're going to start, I think we're going to dwell a little more in this question of digital practice, but what it calls to mind for me is this desire that I think a lot of contemporary architects and designers have now to embrace inherent material properties.
Yes.
But in order to do that, there is this digital kind of intermediary, especially at larger scales, to achieve a kind of representation of the inherent physical properties of a material. And so when I said obstacle earlier, that's kind of what I was thinking. So I just want to kind of plant that seed for a second. But then in addition to that, I think hopefully we'll kind of meander our way back to broader questions of potential, and this term that you've used in the past, found potential.
Okay.
So I think we'll start with the found potential of matter,
right,
and then work our way back to the found potential of site, climate, cultural context.
Okay. All right. Well, it's talking about matter. And the potential of matter as distinct from those other areas of relevance to projects. We began doing a series of research projects, beginning with a very sort of successful project, which was called the Skating Shelters in Winnipeg, which was made out of thin sheets of plywood. Actually a special kind of plywood, but that's another story. But that came about as an initiative on Patricia's part. She was at that time, more frustrated than I was at the issue with the issue of materiality in our work. And she spoke to the need to address materials as a potential, as opposed to the conventional architectural method, which uses materials in a different way, where you design something and then you think about sort of the technologies that are most appropriate for that particular project, and you fill that in, and then everything takes on the configuration that's determined prior to the initiation of an interest in materials. And she wanted to reverse that. Mm-hmm. And so that the skating shelter project was the beginning of that, and we then did a series of projects at that scale.
I'm just curious, I want to jump in and ask, what kind of instigated that desire to reverse this process, beginning not with form but with material?
Yeah, that's a question that she'd probably be better answering okay. than I would, but I will speculate that she was more sensitive perhaps than I was to the pitfall of architectural projects to have a generic character as a function of the use of materials in a generic way. And I think she was more sensitive to that than I was, and pointed that out. But once she'd done that, I was on the case, and certainly joined her in that interest. And so we did begin a series of these things, of studies of really the direct manipulation of materials. What also informed this initiative was a frustration on my part. I was teaching at Yale University about 10 years ago. I taught a number of terms there. And so I was dealing with students who were very bright, who were very technologically skillful. And I was witnessing other studios in the school which focused on digital technology in itself, as opposed to architecture or materials. And I sat in on some of the project reviews, and I was constantly frustrated, because when you would ask, what is it made of? What is your project made of? How do you construct it? The answer was typically, I don't know. We don't know what these forms are. We don't know how they would be made. They're digital forms, which somebody else will figure out how to make. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. That's again, it's a part of the problem of architecture moving too far away from making, and the loss of control, which you inevitably get because of that, and the loss of connection to the made thing. And so I was using these material investigations that we were looking at to think about that issue. And I came to the conclusion that we needed a mechanism where we could construct any forms, as sophisticated and complex geometric forms as you see emerging from digital technology, but as a method of building, where they were informed by how you would make this thing. And that's where the transition from smaller scale direct material manipulation to larger scale, what we call a transition from morphological studies to relational studies. And so the relational investigations had to do with how you put materials in relationship to one another to construct complex geometries but maintaining the material as the unit of construction, mm-hmm. as opposed to an imaginary or unknown material. And so that led to investigation into ruled line forms, and the ability to use conventional materials like a 2x4 to construct a very complex form simply by adjusting the relative position of each adjacent 2x4.
Mm. It's interesting hearing you talk, to imagine you sitting in on these types of studios at a school like Yale, where you're encountering for the first time a very palpable kind of shift or progression in the discipline. And what surprises me is your response to it, because I know a lot of architects who are well established and well rooted in their approach to design, who would encounter that kind of situation, say, for example, a parametric design studio, and be confused and disturbed, maybe, and they would just walk away. And so to hear you kind of express curiosity about it, and then try and, I guess, address the formal concerns that maybe these types of studios or this approach to architecture are raising, but through this kind of, as you call it, relational or contextual mode, I think it's actually quite uncommon, especially for an architect who you're now 40 years into practice.
Right.
And so I guess it's just something that's worth noting, that there is a kind of risk involved possibly in redirecting the course of the practice this late in its genesis or in its kind of evolution.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. I've always sought out, I'm a contrarian by nature. My typical response to things is to think the opposite. But I also seek out the opposite. So I've always been interested in listening to architects and going to lectures by the architects who are least like me. The ones who are most like me, I find objectionable. I really find it sort of, because they're talking about what I know. I just find it less interesting. And so I've always wanted to seek out and things that are other. And when Pat and I travel, which we have done a lot around the world, and it's principally architectural travel, we've always looked for the things that are most unlike us and most sort of different, to try and understand what those things are. And I think it's kept us interested and engaged, which I think is great, because what else would I, would, if you're not, if you lose your engagement with your discipline, then what do you do?
This, I think, is an opportunity now to go back to the beginning. In terms of this feeling of estrangement that I think a practice like yours seems to thrive on. And so PacCow Architects was established not in Vancouver, but in Edmonton, in the late 70s. And the early work in that city or in that region was of a kind of modernist bent. And then for various reasons, I think partially economically, there was a crash in Alberta in the late 70s. The practice moved out west. And with that move, everything seemed to change. And now I know that it's not just the move. I know that there are other things happening in the culture, and notably, people like Kenneth Frampton were writing about ideas about regionalism and context. And to me, I guess the theoretical influence and then the actual influence of location acted on the practice in a really interesting way to fundamentally change your approach to design. And I wonder if we could talk about, I guess, that first of all, that sense of estrangement you had when you moved here from Alberta, and then also after that, we could touch on the influence of theory in the early work.
Okay. Well, I think that I'd like to talk about that period of our practice, because it's not correct.
Okay.
Your interpretation is not correct. What had happened was Pat and I had moved from Winnipeg, where we grew up and went to school, to Toronto at a very bad time. We got there and the economy was collapsing. This was in the late 70s. And I was able to get a job, and Pat was unable to get a job. She was trained as an interior designer. I was trained as an architect. I was able to get a job. I think it was the last job available in Toronto. And so we had a frustrating time because I found that that particular job didn't suit me. I didn't support. It was a very good office and very highly respected office, but I didn't, when I found myself in that office, I didn't support the principles behind the work. So I was unhappy. Pat was unhappy because she didn't have a job. So she applied to graduate school and was accepted at Yale. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I quit my job, and there was no other work in Toronto. Pat went to Yale, and I went to the only place in Canada where there was work, which was Alberta, because of the oil boom that was there at the time. It had never been our intention to relocate to Alberta. It was a circumstantial situation where I was looking for work at the time that she went away to graduate school. And so, but the economy was so buoyant in Alberta, it was wonderful, it was exhilarating, because there was such optimism. In contrast to our experience in Toronto, that we were taken, or I was really caught up in it. And by the time Pat had finished her program at Yale, I had my own practice going. So I had started the practice in my early 30s, literally with virtually no real experience, because there was so much opportunity there. And so our first project was a very large developer project, which was light years beyond our experience capacity. But we struggled through the whole thing.
Don't tell me this was the Galleria.
Yes, it was.
It was. This was your first project.
That was absolutely first project. I had never done a sort of working drawings in my life.
Oh my God.
So anyway.
Help but have this feeling of envy creep all over me now.
Well, but I should say one thing that is needs to be understood is that Pat and I had always planned on ending up in Vancouver. We were absolutely seduced by the landscape, the topography, the mountains and water of the West Coast, and it was our plan to come here. But we started out by going east to Toronto because we wanted to avoid the what we perceived to be the self-indulgent, non-rigorous, non-intellectual attitude of architecture on the West Coast and head for Toronto, where we imagined there would be a great deal more intellectual rigor. We were disappointed in finding that wasn't the case. And so we decided to give up our resistance and allow ourselves to be seduced. And so when the oil economy collapsed in Alberta, we relocated to the West Coast, where we had always intended to end up. So we were simply fulfilling our long-term plan at that point. And regarding the sort of the a perception of a change in the nature of our work, that might well simply be the fact that we were very young in Alberta and we were struggling to find ourselves. Mm-hmm. But when we moved to British Columbia, we had the instant ability to work in a topography that inspired us. Mm-hmm. And so we were home, in a sense, even though we were prairie people, we grew up in Winnipeg. This was the congenial context that we had been looking for. And so we simply found ourselves at home.
I can't help but just dwell a bit on that first project, because I've seen it.
Yeah.
I've been in it. And to me, it's staggering to think that in the context of practice today,
a client or developer would approach a brand new architect with that scale and that complexity of work?
Can you imagine? We were renovating an old Victorian house at the time, which was and the developer, who was a elderly Italian developer who had relocated from Milan to Edmonton, subsequently returned to Milan, but had and was doing this development. And I was a sole practitioner. Pat was working in another office. Huh. I had a drafting board on sawhorses in the shell of a building that we were renovating. And he was still prepared to hire us to do this project. Unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. It just wouldn't happen anymore.
No, it's just staggering, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I guess we could move on from that, but I guess for me, it says a lot about the course that was set for the practice to have had that kind of opportunity early on. Yeah. And there's a question that we don't have to get into now about what it means to be a young practice today and be, I think, more beholden to the kind of specialisms involved and the amount of risk the client perceives that would inhibit them from, I guess, commissioning that kind of project from a young office anymore.
No, I think that's very true. I think there's another important shift, which is that I think our culture has become increasingly more conservative over that period of time as well. Mm. I mean, in the 60s and 70s, Canada was actually an international architectural powerhouse.
Yeah.
We had projects that were of interest around the world. A number of them. There was a huge sort of a powerful wave of innovation in Canadian architecture in the late 60s and early 70s, which has gone. At that time, Europe was still in the process of recovering from the effects of the Second World War, and the economy was when Pat and I graduated, we went to Europe and we traveled on $5 a day in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how powerful the Canadian economy was relative to, say, European economies. Well, that has reversed. Uh-huh. And now you see innovation in European countries, and that's been the case for the last 30 or more years. Much more innovation and ambition than you find in North America. I think that there has been both a shift to a more conservative, risk-averse sort of culture, and in North America, a diminishment of architectural ambition.
Mm.
I don't see a lot of leading-edge work occurring in North America.
Mm. Just as a side note, I think it might be interesting for listeners to hear a bit about these kind of early powerhouses in Canadian architecture or in North American architecture. In your eyes, like, are there a few names we could kind of list just for
absolutely? So there was John Andrews in Toronto, who designed Scarborough College, which was one of the early brutalist megastructures. It was a phenomenal project, and he went on to design the GSE in Harvard and subsequently returned to Australia. There in Montreal, there were a number of very innovative firms, including a firm called ARCOP, which is an acronym, Affleck, et cetera, partners who did Place Bonaventure, and there was Expo 67 in Montreal, which had some fantastic projects in it, including Habitat, Moshe Shafti's best project ever.
Mm-hmm.
There was the German Pavilion, which is an astounding project, which was the test case for ultimately the Munich Olympics.
Mm.
There was the Bucky Fuller Geodesic Dome, all manner of innovative construction in Montreal for the 67 World Fair. There were other projects in Toronto, such as Ontario Place and McMaster University in Hamilton, and the CN Tower in Toronto, which was still the tallest structure in the world until the Burj in Dubai. And then on the West Coast, there was a whole school of small-scale projects by a variety of architects, beautiful West Coast houses, but there was also Simon Fraser University by Erickson Massey. So the Canada was just going nuts and doing some of the best work in the world at the time.
I want to add one more to the list. Douglas Cardinal.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, that's interesting.
A personal favorite. But.
That's very interesting. You know, because I was in Edmonton for a number of years, and Pat and I were there, Douglas Cardinal was there as well. Mm. And I was frustrated by Douglas Cardinal. Mm. I certainly think that the St. Mary's Church that he did in Red Deer is a fantastic project. It's a really brilliant project, and is, again, like Safdie, his first project, I still think is his best project. Mm. After that, the work became less three-dimensional, less volumetric, and more a planimetric curvilinear strategy, which was simply extruded. Mm. And I found that less compelling. And I also was frustrated by the fact that people generally, it took me a long time to understand the virtue, but people generally said to me, well, Douglas Cardinal is an artist. He's not just an architect, because he uses curves. And I thought, well, how low level, you know, how simplistic, simply because he has curves in plan. How is that more artistic than a rectilinear architecture? But that was the general perception. And it's taken me decades to take that advice. And we began to explore curvilinear geometries in three dimensions as part of our material operations work. And it was astounding the general reaction we've received to that body of work. The skating shelters was a global sensation.
Yeah, this is interesting. Ray Kawakubo, who founded Comme des Garçons,
right,
approached you after seeing those skating shelters.
Exactly.
Wanting them to become stainless steel change rooms for his store in Tokyo.
Exactly. Exactly. and that has sort of carried on, and certainly. We have the largest version of those geometries that we've done, which is the Temple of Light in Kootenai Bay in southeastern British Columbia, has also been very popular among a broad audience by virtue of its geometry. Mm. And now that whole line of sort of investigation is being sort of reimagined as furniture, which we're currently developing with a very good quality manufacturer based in Toronto, Nian Camper. So those material operations are now taking the form of chairs of various configurations, and they're all based on the manipulation of steel or wood, which results in a deformation in the material to create a form, which is the furniture. We're finding our way into a variety of new areas as a consequence of that investigation.
It's interesting too that you're kind of entering a different culture of architecture that is more, I want to say, relaxed. And when you say popular, there is a kind of broad appeal to these types of forms. Mm-hmm. There's a seductiveness to the image of these forms that they do well.
That's
visually.
True. That's
and
true.
It also brings to mind designers who've worked for you in the past, who also pursue work at an industrial design scale. Mm-hmm. Through a kind of similar approach, and Omar Arbel in particular is one of them, who I was lucky enough to interview last time I was here.
Oh, okay, good.
But it's the same kind of attitude towards material where you as a designer are asking the material what you can learn from it or what it wants to be by applying various forces to it. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about this approach to design, it's really a kind of rebirth in a way of the practice. And it sounds like you're scaling back, like you're scaling back to furniture in a way that typically practices tend to start with that scale and then move up.
We're not scaling back because we're also involved currently in some of the largest projects that we've ever been involved in.
Right.
Although we did a very large project, which is the Central Library in Montreal, which is a very big building. Mm-hmm. But we're working on similar very large buildings today. So we've moved to very large buildings and going to the small scale design at the same time.
There's a kind of agility there that I imagine must be difficult to manage.
You know, that's an interesting thing. We became aware very early on of the virtue of being able to have facility at different scales, to be able to design small things and large things. And we have always been conscious of the pitfalls of being locked into a certain type of project or scale of project. So there are very successful architects who are very good at small scale projects. Give an example would be Glenn Merkitt in Australia, who does wonderful small scale projects and has made an entire career of that. Similarly, there are architects who are very good at doing extremely large projects. But we've attempted to keep our hands in both extremes in order to gain agility. And I think that it does allow you to transfer this sort of the skills, sensitivities, sensibilities that accrue as a consequence of working in those two different extremes.
Back to this trajectory of the practice, we kind of left off at the move to Vancouver.
Right.
And I guess what we'd established was that this kind of evolution of the work was in some ways as much based on the maturity of the practice and this kind of process of finding a voice or finding a language in architecture as much as it was an influence of the change of place and location.
Right.
Then there's this other part to it that I want to explore now with you, which is the practice's relationship early on to the realm of theory, and particularly through the ideas that were emerging in the early 80s from people like Kenneth Frampton.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've always it's to state the obvious, we've always been very sympathetic to Frampton's investigations into regionalism. And it seemed very natural to us, our interest in the topography, landscape, character of the West Coast. It was easy to spring from that, to generalize from that, to all dimensions of architecture, to be interested in the particular, and we were always trying to find the found potential, which is a expression that we've used in the particular. And in theoretical terms, we were doing this consciously to act as a balance toward the wave of global forces that were taking over culture in the world.
I just want to read something that you said or wrote in 94. There's a selected projects kind of monograph of the practice. And you write that you're trying to find a balance between the general and the particular, and that mass culture is becoming so predominant that the local and the particular are becoming less and less evident. And then you talk about this McDonald's theorem, that international capitalism is creating a uniform global culture. Mm-hmm. And of course, we still feel this so strongly today, and even more so through the rise of digital culture, mm-hmm. which only accelerates
right.
This kind of global idea of design and architecture. But at the same time, you know, I'm going a bit off track here, but let's just entertain the idea okay. that you're instrumentalizing the digital to recover a specificity.
That's a good question. I'm not sure that I agree with that. The specificity comes as a result of an interest in the specific, in the particular. The digital technologies are no different in the sense than a drafting machine or draft or a parallel rule or a set square and a pencil. They all have within them constraints and potentials. And so I wouldn't accept that argument about the digital. I think of it more like simply a tool mm-hmm. which can be used in the interests of a whole variety, a whole spectrum of pursuits. And our interest in the particular and our interest in balancing the general is facilitated by all of these tools, including the digital. Mm.
Is theory a kind of tool for you?
Theory is a tool for us. We have always been interested in the theoretical as a separate inquiry, separate from practice, but as a necessary scaffold within which you practice.
Mm. I'm so happy you used that word.
Yeah, it occurred to me that it was the right word to use. But at the same time, our interest in theory is not as urgent as it was when we were starting out. When we were beginning, we actually had to construct a position for ourselves. And as that position has sort of filled in and filled out and become more a manner of thinking, it's become less urgent an issue for us. And I think that's potentially a problem, and certainly it's easy to fall into habitual ways, and we certainly have those. At the same time, we do attempt, as we've discussed earlier in this discussion, an interest to always find the other, to always try and expose ourselves to different approaches and different results. And to take them seriously and to try and take what we can from them. Certainly, there is virtually no architect who's worked diligently at their craft, regardless of their point of view, that we don't find has value for us. And so we continue to be quite omnivorous in terms of our architectural consumption. And that has kept the world of architecture interesting and lively for us.
I think we could end there, but I do have one more question.
Okay.
And it has to do with the identity of the practice. Mm-hmm. And specifically the kind of national identity. Mm-hmm. You were talking earlier about the kind of leveling out of the caliber of Canadian or to a certain extent North American yeah. architecture. And yet Pacquiao Architects is kind of upheld as a kind of high watermark of Canadian architecture. Mm-hmm. And I guess there's a question about like the national identity of the practice. And before we go there, again, early on, a critic, Ben Yesed,
yeah.
who wrote this introduction to this early monograph on the practice, was trying to tease out what he called a Canadian duality between, on the one hand, elemental Aboriginal culture, and on the other hand, this kind of urbane European heritage that we have as colonial subjects.
Right.
And so I guess what I want to talk about is Canadianness and the tension that is felt in a kind of post-colonial context.
Right.
It's a broad question.
Well, it's a broad question. It's a couple of things. Our interest and our sort of Canadianness is in some ways simply a reflection of the fact that we practice in Canada, by and large, although we have done quite a number of projects in the U.S., and we've had been very unsuccessful at getting at actually accomplishing them. Mm. We've won quite a number of competitions, which have never been constructed, beginning with a large project in Texas.
The Nursing Biomedical the
Nursing
Center.
And, Nursing and Biomedical Sciences Building. We won a housing project at the University of Pennsylvania. We won the competition for cottages at Falling Water.
Yes.
We've done quite a bit of work in the U.S. and worked on projects there for extended periods of time, which never got built. And one of the things that we have found is that the competitions we won in Canada have almost all been built. And I actually think that in that regard, that's I would say that the U.S. by and large is more conservative than Canada is. And those projects, which were ambitious projects, ultimately didn't happen because they were pushing too hard. Whereas the similar projects that we have won in Canada actually have been constructed. So that's, I think, my experience, which would suggest that Canada is actually a more fertile ground, I guess you might say, proportionally to the U.S. Obviously, there are some remarkable architectural practices and projects in the U.S. But if you think about the fact that the U.S. is 10 times the size of Canada, I wouldn't suggest that there are 10 times more interesting things happening there than there are in Canada.
Mm.
So, returning to the question of Canadianness, we have, though, won projects all across the country in competition. So, library in Montreal, an art museum in Waterloo, Ontario, a sports facility in Toronto, art museum in Thunder Bay, a library in Winnipeg, et cetera, et cetera. And so we have developed a national practice as a consequence of winning competitions, which was the way in which our practice has grown and survived until, I would say, relatively recently, where we are now beginning to actually, after being in Vancouver for 35 years, have a practice, a local practice, which is actually self-sustaining. Until very recently, we could never have survived on work in the West Coast. We were absolutely dependent on work in other parts of Canada simply to survive. Mm. Of course, the consequence is we practiced from almost across the entire country in all of the major cities in Canada. In that sense, are one of the more, even though we're a relatively small practice, are one of the more national practices. And as a consequence as well, we've partnered with local firms because that's how those competitions are actually achieved, and developed relationships that are across the country. There are a few other firms that do that, but for a firm of our size, that's exceptional.
Mm. And then there's this post-colonial question, which I kind of find difficult to articulate clearly, but maybe if we go back to that duality of the elemental kind of Aboriginal context of the kind of land or landscape and the urbane European heritage.
Yeah.
Like, do you feel there's one specific project that might help guide us through this last question, which is the Seabird Island School, which was completed in 1988 and became a kind of hallmark for the practice during that era, designed in part in collaboration with an Aboriginal community in response to a colonial past of residential schools. And so to me, that's an interesting project to kind of capture the tension that might be felt as an architect coming into this very kind of fraught and like tense kind of recent history,
yeah,
and acting within it.
Well, I think that, you know, that too is an interesting question, and it's something that is not an issue in large parts of the world. In Asia and Europe, that question doesn't exist, whereas it does exist in North America and Australia and New Zealand and those countries. And certainly in British Columbia, which the First Nations communities generally have not given away their claims to land by treaty as they have in the rest of North America. And so they are a force to be reckoned with. And there are, by virtue of remoteness and location, communities which still maintain a very vital sort of continuity of culture. And so we've had to interact with these communities and to accept them, and they have, and of course they're similarly obliged to interact with us and accept us, and we've found, I think, a meeting place, and it has informed our work, and it is consistent with our interest in the particular as opposed to the general, and a response to the particularities of culture, their particularities of culture, is completely consistent with our general interests in the particular. Mm. And so it was a very natural response of ours to try and understand the cultural history and interests and values of the Seabird Island community, and we discovered that through interaction with them, and we attempted to develop a project which reflected their cultural values and in a sense forms, without being literal and without being patronizing, because there is the real trap of falling into cliche and a patronizing representation of their culture as a colonial architect. Mm. And so fortunately, we are now developing a community of First Nations architects, and so they are claiming their dependence on our professional skills as a community is diminishing. They have their own architects, which I think it will be very interesting to see what the result of that is. But it was a real sort of formative power, our interaction with that community at sort of an early point in our career. And then subsequently to move across country, working in Montreal, was also an engagement with a different culture, a Francophone culture, which was also a culture that was in reaction against a different form of colonialism. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were colonialists themselves, but then they were subsequently colonized by the English world. Uh-huh. And so that was a different form of that experience. And it has led us, I think, to attempt to be sensitive to subtle differences in culture. Working in Thunder Bay, for example, where we're currently developing an art museum, which happens to have a very strong collection, 95% of which is First Nations art. Mm. Again, has resulted in a tweaking of the work to reflect the distinct nature of the community in Thunder Bay. And so we try and be really sensitive and attuned to all of those nuances of difference that exist even between urban and rural situations. Mm.
John, thank you so much for your time.
You're more than welcome. I've enjoyed talking to you.
You've been listening to Scaffold. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and I produce the show. The theme music is composed and performed by Andrew Rayworth of the band Stanley Park, with additional music this week by Caribou. Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @scaffold_podcast. Thank you to John Patkow and to the Architecture Foundation for supporting the show. Thanks as always to Scandal Lynn, and thanks to you for listening. I'll see you again in 2 weeks.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.